Morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Today, we continue our series of weekly conversations with candidates for mayor of Baltimore City. David Warnock joins me to make his case on what sets him apart in this year's crowded race for Charm City's top job. He's 57 years old, a Democrat, and a successful businessman. He's the founder of a private equity firm and the chairman of a charitable foundation which has funded a variety of projects, including the Green Street Academy, a charter school in West Baltimore. Then, former Baltimore Sun pop music critic Rashad Olson joins me to talk about his new book, Soul Serenade, Rhythm, Blues, and Coming of Age Through Vinyl. It's a memoir about seeking refuge in music and literature as he navigated the treacherous paths of a difficult childhood. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Nathan's got the latest local news. We'll start with these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. So glad you are with us today. We continue our series of conversations with people who have announced their intention to run for mayor of Baltimore. As of today, as Nathan has been reporting, 12 Democrats and 4 Republicans have registered with the Board of Elections to be on the April 26th primary ballot. 1 Green Party candidate, 2 independents, and 5 unaffiliated candidates have also registered for the general election. The deadline to file for a place on the ballot is by the end of business today. We're spending every Wednesday here on Maryland Morning speaking with candidates about their vision for the city. Today, my guest is David Warnock. He's a Democrat. He is 58 years old. He lives in the Inner Harbor. He is the father of 3 children. He came to Baltimore in 1983 to work as a fund manager for T. Rowe Price. In 1995, he founded a private equity firm called Camden Partners. He's also the chairman of the Warnock Foundation, a charitable foundation that has supported organizations like the Center for Urban Families and the Green Street Academy. That's a charter school that Mr. Warnock helped fund and helped found in West Baltimore. He has never held political office. David Warnock, welcome to the show. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be back at WIPR. I have to admit I miss Baltimore's future, so it's great to be back in the studios.
Well, we're glad to have you. A few months ago, but while you were just sort of thinking about running for mayor, you told me that you were attracted to this job like a moth to a flame. Why? What's so attractive about this particular gig?
Well, because Baltimore deserves better. I think at some fundamental level, our city government has failed the citizens of Baltimore on almost every front. And I fundamentally believe, because I've spent time at the Center for Urban Families, you know, for 15 years as its chairman, that we have the talent in this town. And at Green Street Academy, I see 625 kids that we're taking to a bright future. And I just felt like I could do that across this great city. And it was a good time in my life.
You have made a virtue out of the fact that you have no political experience. Your television commercials and in your speeches and on your website, you play up the fact that you're not a politician. And let's assume for a moment that a lot of folks don't trust politicians, and that's certainly a theme that we've heard, particularly on the political right, since Reagan in the 1980s. But you know, on the other hand, with the economic crisis in 2008, Bank of America paid $120 billion in fines. J.P. Morgan Chase paid $71 billion in fines. Citigroup, $32 billion in fines. Nobody went to jail. They all obviously admitted that they were doing terrible things. Nobody's been criminally prosecuted. Why would people trust people in business any more than they would trust people in politics?
Well, you know, I think this is about connecting with people. And my point about being a business person is that I've been solving problems and bringing people together, bringing great teams together to solve problems for a long period of time, whether it's in the private sector with the companies that I've started, or in the not-for-profit sector with the Warnock Foundation or Green Street or the Center for Urban Families. I just do more listening than talking, and I think that that's really important. You know, one of the things I'm really excited about is that we're going to launch a turnaround tour starting tomorrow with my old pickup truck. We're going to visit all 276 neighborhoods in this great city over the next 82 days, doing more listening than talking. We're going to start in Seton Hill and Mount Vernon and Midtown Belvedere, Upton. But we're going to move across our city talking to people and listening to people. And I think that I do that.
A lot of folks might suggest that you've done such great work in your charitable work, your philanthropic work. I mean, you've been widely applauded and justly so for Green Street and Center for Urban Families and the other projects that you've gotten behind with the foundation. Some folks would suggest you could probably do more from that position of philanthropy than as the mayor. I mean, as the philanthropist, you can decide, here's a good project, here's good people, let's fund them, let's support them, let's give them what they need without the mess and bother of the city council and, you know, finding coalitions, et cetera, in political office. Why do you think you can be, or what do you think you can do as the mayor that you're not able to do as a corporate citizen and as a philanthropist?
Bring people together. Bring people together. I fundamentally believe that we have the talent in this town to solve the problems that are in front of us. I don't believe that we need to go to Oakland to hire the next chief of police. I want to create a promote from within culture at the police department, at the fire department, at North Avenue, and throughout city government. I want to create a culture of customer service in city government that just simply doesn't exist today. You know, throughout this great city, I talk to people who do not feel well served by city government. And I fundamentally believe that the mayor's office needs to be not the place where great ideas go to die. It needs to be the place where great ideas go to flourish and blow up, and that the mayor of this city needs to be, yes, cheerleader in chief. At this critical time in our city's history, we need somebody that will step up and say, this is a great place. Move your company here. Move here if you're a young person. You've got a bright future. And I can do that.
David Warnock is my guest. He's one of 12 Democratic candidates for the office of mayor of the city of Baltimore on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall, and this is Maryland Morning. You're going to face, if you are elected, you're going to face fiscal challenges. Mayor Rawlings Blake has said that this is a year of fiscal austerity. She's called on all city agencies to propose spending cuts of up to 5% per department. She's predicting a $75 million shortfall for this fiscal year. How do you affect change? How do you, if you bring these people together, what resources can you offer them in fact, implement change?
Well, you know, it's not just about the $75 million shortfall that she's projected this year. It's about the $744 million shortfall that's projected over the next 6 years. You know, we haven't had audits of our municipal function since William Donald Schaefer was mayor. So first and foremost, we need to have truly independent audits of all of our municipal functions. You know, when Gregory Thornton, for example...
Do you trust the $744 million figure? I mean, if we don't know, if the audits haven't been done, I mean, are these figures just sort of, you know, ballpark guesstimates?
One would suggest that they are probably not low, right?
Mm-hmm.
One would suggest...
So it could be worse.
One would think that they would be worse. One could be worse, you know. But I think first and foremost, we have to get in there and find out what's going on. You know, and I think that for someone with a business background, someone like me that's actually been on audits of committees of companies, right, can lead the charge on that. We need great management in our city. We need to have a mayor that attracts talent. And frankly, one of the things that I've done throughout my career is been a magnet for talent. You know, I've been able to surround myself with great people like Joe Jones at the Center for Urban Families and Crystal Harden and Jerry South that runs Town Park, who have made me, frankly, Tom, look infinitely more effective and smarter than I really am. But I'm not afraid to surround myself with A players. We got to do that in city government. That's how we'll get to the bottom of where we're spending the money, and then we can reallocate capital back to our schools and things that we all care about.
So you've used this analogy of a turnaround. You want to make Baltimore the best turnaround story, you know, ever. You've turned around companies in your business life. Where's the analogy? I mean, a city isn't a company. A city is an organic, dynamic place with all sorts of different constituencies and a different emotional, philosophical, psychological component to a company. I mean, if you're turning around a company, you're beholden to shareholders, you know, and they're to make money. It's a whole where's the analogy between a city turnaround and a corporate turnaround?
Well, I think that the analogy is apt because whether you're a company or whether you're a city, you have constituencies that have to believe in themselves. And I think at some fundamental level, we have a culture of low expectations in Baltimore. And one of the things that I think our next administration needs to do, and I can certainly lead that and I'm looking forward to, is smashing that culture of low expectations. You know, I look at what Mike Duggan's doing in Detroit, for example. You know, Mike Duggan is changing the narrative of Detroit. If you go to Detroit, Detroit has much deeper problems than we have. But Mike Duggan's changing the narrative of it. Mike Bloomberg did that in New York in many ways. So I think that the analogy of writing the greatest turnaround story in America is first and foremost getting the people of Baltimore to believe that there's a better and a different way. When we do that, we have the talent here. It will radiate. It will reflect. We'll bring companies to town. We'll bring new talent to town. And we'll begin to believe in ourselves. That's really what it's all about.
How come those pitches, whatever those pitches have been to date to bring new companies to town, to create more employment opportunities, what has failed about that? What's wrong with the pitch so far that has not accomplished that? What's different about your pitch than the pitch of Mayor Rawlings Blake or Mayor Dixon or Mayor O'Malley?
You know, I think that Baltimoreans have a really keen eye for authenticity. And one of the reasons why I'm excited about doing the turnaround tour, one of the reasons why I think our first ads have been resonating with me and my old pickup truck, that really is my pickup truck that I rolled into Baltimore in 33 years ago when I had a load of student loans and the promise of a great job. You know, everything I've made in Baltimore. And I think Baltimoreans have a really keen eye for authenticity. You know, I think, what I would ask the listeners is, you know, hit the hashtag turnaround tour, because if you want us in your barbershop or you want us in your restaurant, we'll be there over the course of the next 82 days, you know, because I think people really care about authenticity. And Baltimore really has given me every opportunity that I have, and I want to give it back to the citizens of this great city.
We're going to take a little break for news here, but before we do, I agree with you that folks are, you know, hip to authenticity. But again, what would your pitch be? How would your pitch differ from the pitches to businesses, for example, that have been made to date?
I think at the end of the day, you have to have authenticity by delivering on your promises. I tell people I'm about jobs and opportunity. I'm about real change. But third, in many ways, most importantly, I've delivered on my promises. You know, if you look at the Center for Urban Families, there's been 25,000 people that have gone through that thing since I've been the chairman of it. There's 625 kids on North Hilton Parkway, and we put $20 million into that building that both Elijah Cummings and William Donald Schaefer went to middle school in. So over and over again, I've delivered on my promises.
And we will hear more about that after a break. For news, businessman and foundation chair David Warnock, he's one of 12 Democrats running in the April 26th primary for mayor. There are 22 candidates overall for that office. We'll have more with David Warnock after a break for the news. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Nathan, back to you.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Welcome back, everybody, to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we are continuing our weekly series of conversations with candidates for mayor of the city of Baltimore. This morning, Democratic candidate David Warnock joins me. He has never held political office, but he has been active in civic affairs, particularly in the last several years. He is the former chair of the Greater Baltimore Committee, and he was a co-founder of the Green Street Academy, a charter school in West Baltimore. He's 58 years old. He is the managing partner of Camden Partners, a private equity firm that he co-founded in 1995. He also heads a charitable foundation called the Warnock Foundation. So, David, you talk a lot about how you have created jobs in your position in the private, positions in the private sector. How do you do that as the mayor? What does the mayor do? What is the impact of that office and that person in job creation in the city of Baltimore?
Well, first and foremost, we have to improve our schools. You know, I just put out my education policy yesterday, and I was very grateful that Lisa Gladden, a well-respected state senator, endorsed me. And one of the reasons why she endorsed me is she's enthusiastic about my education policies, and I'm very grateful for her courageous support of my candidacy. But one of the things that we're doing at Green Street Academy is we are graduating kids from high school with certifications that will allow them to get the job of their choice coming out of high school. And these are healthcare certifications where we're working with University of Maryland, energy certifications where we're working with BG&E that helped put our solar panels in that power the school, and technology certifications with Microsoft and hopefully Cisco in the future. So first and foremost, we have to graduate our kids from high school with a toolkit that allows them, if they don't go to a 2 or 4 year college, to be enthusiastic about something that gets them into the workplace. That's a job creator. The other thing that we need to do is have a mayor that works with our major anchor institutions to bring their suppliers to Baltimore. I am excited, and I've told Ron Peterson this and Jay Perman at the University of Maryland, that I want to go with them to talk to their top 20 suppliers. And I want to make the pitch that Baltimore is a great place to move your business. And I want to have Hopkins or Under Armour or University of Maryland just simply say, you know, we'd do more business with you if you moved your manufacturing plant here or your regional headquarters here. And having a mayor that understands making a pitch and having me as mayor say, you know what, if you move your business here, here's what we can do for you in Baltimore, because we have a great workforce. We have the capability of really treating you great if you come to town. That will bring businesses to town. And then I've been a long advocate for removing the barriers that people have, whether they're returning citizens or not, to getting jobs. Automatic expungement of non-conviction is something we could talk about for a half an hour. I've been a big advocate of that.
When it comes to education, as you well know, back in 1997 during the Schmoke administration, control of the city schools was handed over to the state in return for about $254 million of funding for a then basically bankrupt school system. What control, what impact, what influence can a mayor or the city of Baltimore have on a school system that, you know, we don't have complete authority over?
Well, first and foremost, the mayor of the city has a huge influence over the public schools. You know, the mayor of this city is the driver behind the selection of the superintendent of the schools. And the mayor of this city sets the tone, right? I will set the tone as a mayor that deeply cares about education, because I've not only put my money behind my mouth, but I've also walked the walk for a long period of time with Green Street Academy and other education initiatives that I've worked on. So the mayor has a huge amount of influence on it. The other thing that I think that we need to do right away is create a partially elected school board. People in Baltimore, and I go around and I'm, again, I hit my hashtag turnaround tour, will be in 276 neighborhoods over the next 82 days. But people all over Baltimore, parents feel disconnected to what goes on in our school district. The selection process for the school board is totally opaque. The selection process for the superintendent is opaque. I'm a huge advocate of a partially elected school board, not just for transparency, but to make people in this city feel connected to the institution that in many ways is the most important one in the city, and that's our school system.
What about Greg Thornton? If there's a Mayor Warnock, will there be a CEO named Thornton of the public schools?
He's a guy that walked into a huge budget deficit. You know, one of the things that I'll evaluate all of the heads of the departments in my administration on is, can you create a promote from within culture? I've told this to the superintendent of police. He's a great guy, Davis. That I want to have a problem. I want to have a problem because when you retire, I want to have three candidates, internal candidates, that we have to pick from. And you know what? If we don't pick A's probably going to get picked off and go to Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. So I want to create, and I will demand of the head of my departments, a promote from within culture so that we don't go to Milwaukee, where we got Gregory Thornton, a perfectly good guy, or we go to Oakland to get Tony Batts. I want to create a culture in city government that is about promoting from within and customer service.
How about taxes? A couple of your opponents have called for a fairly significant cut in the process. property tax in the city of Baltimore. Is that something that you're interested in doing? And what is the impact of taxes on people's desire or lack thereof to live in the city and to do business in the city?
You know, I like to say with respect to the North Avenue, you know, if you can't count the number of students, how can you say that every student counts? I mean, it's crazy that we can't count the number of students in Baltimore City Schools. It's crazy that we haven't had audits of municipal functions since William Donald Schaefer was mayor. It's crazy that Gregory Thornton finds $3.6 million worth of annual expenses at North Avenue in ghost employees and spouses that weren't spouses on the health care plan. Now, first and foremost, we need to do real audits of our municipal functions in Baltimore City. And let me say parenthetically, this problem has gone on for years and years and years. And the same politicos who have been around our city for a long time are not going to solve this problem. This is why we need someone with a business mind in this office. So first and foremost, we need to find out where we're spending our money. Then we can look at cutting taxes. Then we can look at spending more money on our schools. But at the end of the day, I think it's irresponsible to go out and promise tax cuts when I haven't really done an independent audit of the thing that's producing the revenues.
On 881, I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, David Warnock. He's one of 12 Democratic candidates for the city of Baltimore's mayoral. In the mayoral race, the primary election for the Democrats and the Republicans is the 26th of April. You mentioned Police Commissioner Davis. You have a good feeling about him, a good opinion of him. You don't expect to be exercising the buyout option on his contract if you're elected?
It's an expensive buyout option, but he's a good man, you know, and he will be evaluated. And I'm looking forward to working with him to create a promote from within culture. You know, if you think about it, imagine a company where the person who's in the middle of the business, a middle manager or a person coming into the company, a young cop joining the force, doesn't believe that they can ever get the top job. Now, we can't have that in our city government, because if you think about that, it creates a culture of indifference. And if our police feel indifferent, then they're going to treat the customers that they serve with indifference. So one of the things that we need to do is treat everyone in our city with respect. And I think that includes treating our police with respect. One of the reasons why I'm doing my turnaround tour, 276 neighborhoods over the next 82 days, is that I respect the people of this city, and I want to do more listening than talking. I get my best ideas by hanging around Monroe Street at the Center for Urban Families or talking to the parents at Green Street Academy. I will get great ideas over the course of the next 82 days about what we need to do to move this city ahead by driving my old pickup truck around this great city.
If you're elected mayor and if Commissioner Davis remains the commissioner, we'll have a majority black city and a white mayor and a white police commissioner. What does that mean?
You know, it's interesting when I go out and I talk to people throughout this great city, and I'll go back and I will say, you know, how grateful I am to have the endorsement of one of the most well-respected African-American state senators, Lisa Gladden. And I would encourage everybody to look at my website on the validators of all races that are talking about my campaign. I think we need a mayor that brings people together. And when I talk to people across this great city, I'm not sure they've told me time and time again that they don't care whether the mayor of this city is blue or pink. If that mayor creates jobs and opportunity and delivers on their promises, that's the person they want in that office.
Should police officers, or for that matter, any employee of the city of Baltimore, be required to live in Baltimore?
I think we need to create incentives for them to live in Baltimore. You know, one of the things that I'm looking forward to do is creating real incentives for our police to live in Baltimore, doing things like creating incentives for them to have homes in the city. Good grief, we have enough empty homes in our city. We should create a plan to give them to our cops, allow our cops to drive their police cars home at night, right? Do things like that that increase the connectivity between our police officers and the people that they are paid to serve. Again, this is about creating a culture of community service and a culture where people who have gotten out of the habit in Baltimore of talking to each other begin to talk to each other again. You know, it's interesting, on a parenthetical on that one, it's amazing how disconnected, for example, the faith-based community, which I have been, you know, I'm a proud member of Kingdom Life Church on Hilton Parkway. The faith-based community in Baltimore does some of the best on-the-ground work in this city, day in and day out, and yet they are very disconnected from the foundation community. The mayor of this city can bring them together around important problems like community schools.
Talk a little bit about community schools. You're talking about making schools be really more than just places for education. You're talking about making them sort of hubs for the neighborhoods in which they're in. That can be a very effective paradigm. It can also be a very expensive model.
Well, I don't think in Baltimore it needs to be an expensive model, because what we're talking about doing is moving the provision of city services from a centralized model right out to the schools. So yes, at Green Street Academy, we have a 125-foot-long greenhouse and a tilapia farm and solar panels to teach the kids science, math, and entrepreneurship, and it's really working, and the kids will graduate with the certifications that I talked about. But in many ways of equal importance, we recognize that the kids' mental health and physical health is of equal importance. I've had 4 kids at Green Street since the beginning of the school year lose their fathers to gun-related violence. So our kids are coming to school with PTSD and stress-related disorders. We have a great partnership, for example, with Kingdom Life Church. So when a kid is chronically absent from school, members of the church go visit the family, not to proselytize, but to find out what are the services that that kid needs. Because a kid who's chronically absent isn't a kid that's staying home watching TV. It's a symbol of a deeper problem. And so a community school links all of the services that kids need in order to move ahead, as well as parents. You know, at Green Street, we're beginning to offer certifications for the parents of our kids as well. So that's the community school model that we can build and run across our city. There's already examples of it throughout us. Green Street is not the only great school in Baltimore City.
All right, David, that's all the time we have this morning. I appreciate your coming by, and thanks, and we shall see you as the campaign continues.
Good. Always a pleasure.
David Warnock is a Democratic candidate for mayor of Baltimore City. We'll continue our conversations with all the mayoral candidates and people seeking other offices in Maryland next Wednesday and every Wednesday leading up to the April 26th primary election. Next week, my guest will be Democratic candidate State Senator Catherine Pugh. There are a number of mayoral forums coming up. Next Tuesday night from 6 to 8, there'll be a forum at the Booker T. Washington Middle School. That's sponsored by the University of Baltimore Black Law Students Association and several other community organizations. Also, this isn't a forum, but you may be interested that tonight at 7:30 at Red Emma's Bookstore in Station North, author Steve Phillips will discuss his new book, Brown is the New White, in which he examines the intersection of race and politics. We've got links with details of all these events on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. If you are not registered to vote, you have until April 5th to register to be able to participate in this important election. We've got a link on our website with registration information. If you know people who aren't registered, please come to our website and send them the link.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Only you. Can't heal my soul, Sarah.
Ah, yes, Aretha. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Maryland Morning.
I'm Tom Hall. My next guest is Rashad Olison, the former pop music critic for the Baltimore Sun. He's written a memoir that chronicles how music helped him navigate the rough terrain of his childhood. After his parents divorced when he was very young, he and his two sisters moved frequently with their mother as she held multiple jobs trying to provide for the family. As Rashad grew up, he struggled with adjusting to a barrage of new schools, as well as the isolation that he felt because he was gay. He turned to music and to literature for comfort, inspiration, and hope. The book is called Soul Serenade, Rhythm, Blues, and Coming of Age Through Vinyl. Rashad Olison joins me on the phone from his home in Virginia Beach. Good morning, Rashad. How you doing?
I'm fine. You know, I'm actually right here in D.C. I have a reading tonight. I'm at my hotel.
Oh, terrific. All right. Well, I'm glad you're safe and warm in this rainy Wednesday morning. So you grew up in rural Arkansas, Hot Springs, Little Rock, and you talk about how the neighbors could be identified by the music they played. So it sounds like music was a constant soundtrack to you when you were a little kid.
Oh, absolutely. Music was almost like another relative. You know, it was such a strong presence in the community. In the summertime in the projects, and even when the weather was warm, it didn't have to necessarily be summer, people would pull their big stereo speakers out on the porch, or you could always hear music blaring in the park nearby, and you knew who was up or you knew whose house it was by what was coming out. So it defined for me that time, that place, and the neighbors and family members who were around.
Tell us about your family. You had two sisters, Dusa and Reagan. Tell us about them and your mom and another character in your life, Mama Tea Cake.
Well, I grew up with my two sisters, Dusa, who's she's about 9 years older than I am, and she was something of like a second mother growing up. While I was writing this book, I didn't realize how young she was with all the responsibilities she had. My mother worked two full-time jobs, so my older sister was pretty much like another parent in the house after my folks' divorce. My sister Reagan is 1 year and 5 days younger than I am, so we were very close in age, and, you know, running buddies growing up and sort of had each other's back and still do in a way. I mean, our lives are very different now. They're still in Arkansas, well-adjusted, married with children. They're very, you know, suburban lives, and in fact, Dusa has grandchildren. Her children are grown now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, given the type of childhood we came out of, it's great to see how well-adjusted we are. And Mama Tea Cake is no longer with us. She's an interesting character in the book in that she's not the stereotypical grandmotherly figure. She absolutely was not. She was a bootlegger. She had been an abandoned child too, and so that was one of the things of writing the book that I noticed in the family, this pattern of abandonment, be it emotional or physical or both, and how those scars run very deep, and how they color how we see each other and how we go through life.
Tell us about your dad. When he was drafted and served in Vietnam, and when he came back from Vietnam, he was a very different person. And then your mom and dad finally divorced when you were about 6 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. He was raised in a very close-knit family. He was raised on East Section Line, a road in Malvern, Arkansas, that was probably the most rural part of Malvern. There's, you know, plenty of gardens and all of that, and he couldn't go two doors down without, you know, family members being everywhere. So he was surrounded by family, very sheltered. He was drafted in Vietnam after high school, and he had never left Malvern. So he had gone from Malvern to Vietnam, the shelter boy, and was completely traumatized over there. He was trained as a sniper, and he had a nervous breakdown and was addicted to heroin and was dishonorably discharged. And, you know, I was born in 1977, so about 7 years, well, 4 years after he'd come back. And from all accounts, he was never the same. You know, he was always addicted to something after that. And in writing about him, he was a very complex guy. I mean, very affectionate, very emotionally available to us, but so troubled. And the opposite of my mother, who was emotionally distant. But in writing about him, I realized that, you know, those psychological problems he had, you know, had gone untreated, and of course, eventually got the best of him. He died at 45, and You know, I missed him a lot. You know, he fostered my love for music. And
yeah, it was his record collection that first got you turned on to music.
That's right.
And you write, you know, really eloquently about some of the tunes that were really important to you. Describe for us the reverence with which your first grade classmates greeted your show-and-tell presentation of Michael Jackson's Thriller. That's a great scene in the book.
You know, I was a shy kid and very lonely, and so no one noticed me in class. I was always in the back, and it was show-and-tell, and I was so proud of that record. I think it had been out about a year, but that record was big on the charts for a good 2 years. And so it was at the peak of its popularity. I had the album, took to school. Everybody noticed me, and everybody was like, oh, he got the Thriller album. And my teacher put it on, and the class morphed into this little elementary disco. And I was a popular kid just for that day. Everybody, you know, started ignoring me the next day, but I was, you know, king of the hill that day.
Here's another woman that had a great impact on your young life. Chaka Khan, you write, I could close my eyes and become nothing. I could exhale and surrender to a woman who tamed lions in her backyard and kept a full moon somewhere in her purse. Mm-hmm. Chaka Khan. But this book really was a way of your processing and thinking about these traumatic events that happened to you as a kid.
Absolutely. The music provided a sense of refuge and solace. Even when I didn't understand the lyrics, I understood that the performance conveyed a strength and a resilience that I wanted to embody. When I discovered Chaka Khan and Daddy's Records, I was around maybe the fourth grade, and that's around the time I was being bullied. And the way she sang, the way she wailed, to me just sounded like defiance. She sounded like another, just otherworldly to me in a way. And I said, you know what, it wasn't that I wanted to be her, but I wanted to embody what that sound was like, to stand in who I was, whoever that was going to be. And so listening to her, people like Gladys Knight, and of course Aretha Franklin, and Bobby Womack and David Ruffin, this you know, mixture of strength and vulnerability. I wanted to embody that somehow.
Well, it's a very interesting read, and I appreciate your time this morning, and have a good trip to Baltimore tomorrow when you have an event. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you very much.
Rashad Ollison, his new memoir is called Soul Serenade, Rhythm, Blues, and Coming of Age Through Vinyl. Rashad Ollison will be speaking about the book tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Maryland State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped on Park Avenue at Franklin Street in Baltimore. It's part of the Enoch Pratt Library's Writers Live series. That's it for us today. On Friday, a conversation about the role of Islam in the African-American community here in Baltimore. President Obama is coming to Catonsville today to visit the Islamic Center of Baltimore. We'll talk about that visit, and we'll also get our annual Oscar prognostications from our movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday. The Oscars this year, once again, not nominating any actors of color. We'll talk about that and about the future of the Academy Awards. That's all coming up Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.